Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
The ultimate measure of a man is not where he stands in moments of comfort and convenience, but where he stands at times of challenge and controversy. For weeks now, in the eyes of much of the world, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has embodied that quotation from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Zelensky made the courageous decision to stay in Kyiv. He's made canny use of both social and broadcast media around the world. He's perceptive of his audience, knowing that a message is only truly effective if it's heard. So, listen to how he addressed, via live video feed, Britain's Parliament last week.
And I would like to remind you the words that the United Kingdom have already heard, which are important again. We will not give up and we will not lose. We will fight till the end, at sea, in the air. We will continue fighting for our land, whatever the cost. We will fight in the forests, in the fields, on the shores, in the streets. We will fight on the banks of different rivers like Dnieper. And we are looking for your help, for the help of the civilized countries.
Zelensky was evoking British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who, on June 4, 1940, reported to the House of Commons the peril Britain faced from Germany's advance. This is from a recording recreated after Churchill spoke.
We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is premature to suggest that Volodymyr Zelensky is another Winston Churchill right now. He is still desperate to turn the international accolades into more of the material assistance he wants for Ukraine. Today, Zelensky speaks to Canada's Parliament, and tomorrow, the United States Congress. So we're going to look more deeply right now at the kind of leader he's become. Gina Scott-Ligon joins us. She studies leadership and is director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation Technology and Education Center at the University of Nebraska-Omaha. And she's with us from Omaha. Gina Scott-Ligon, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. Thanks for doing this program.
Also with us today is Max Hastings. He's a military historian, journalist, columnist for the London Times and Bloomberg, author of many books, including Winston's War, Soldiers, Great Stories of War and Peace, and a forthcoming book on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Max Hastings, welcome to you.
My pleasure.
So let me just first ask you both, and Gina, I'll just turn to you initially. What was your first response to the man who emerged on the world scene and to the Ukrainian people themselves on February 24th?
Well, Meghna, I study extreme leadership. So, you know, how individuals get others to do enormous feats of bravery and move energy toward a cause that they care about. And so he's one of three types that I've seen in my career of looking at these. He's what we would call a charismatic leader. And one of the things that I had to do when I first saw him doing some of the selfies is just kind of smile to myself, because he understands and how to leverage emotions in today's media environment like no leader that I have seen to date. And just the content of what he says, I mean, he pulls on human emotions from all types of people. And it's just thrilling to watch as a leadership scholar how this is playing out in real time.
Mm-hmm. Max Hastings, I'm going to come to you in a moment. But since Gina did mention Zelensky's now I would say it's verging on iconic moment where he stood on a street in Kyiv and said, "I'm here." It happened on the third day of the Russian invasion. And here's a moment from that video.
Good morning to everyone, Ukrainians. Lately, there has been a lot of fake information online that are call on our army to lay down arms and to evacuate. Listen, I am here. We will not lay down the weapons. We will defend our state because our weapon is our truth. And the truth is that this is our land, our country, our children, and we will defend all of that. Glory to Ukraine.
Max Hastings, your thoughts.
It has been genuinely inspirational listening to Zelensky. Hard not to remember that a few months ago, before this war started, he had from his own people only a 25% approval rating. And suddenly, the qualities, he was often derided as a mere television comedian, but the very qualities, the media savvy that he had, the fact that he's a professional communicator, has suddenly transformed him into something remarkable, as is his courage. And it has. I mean, I personally believe that we are witnessing, alas, because it's not good news, the beginnings of a new era in which I think that the first Cold War, which we thought lay well behind us, I think we're now looking at a new Cold War in which Ukraine is first in the front line. That Zelensky reminds us of a truth about all great leaders through the ages. Words are their most important tools. Words are more than mere weapons. If one looks at all the great leaders through the ages, what they've had is an ability to inspire and communicate with their people. And Winston Churchill, he transformed, he made the English language his foremost weapon, even at a time when Britain, as a fighting power against Germany, was almost disarmed. So what Zelensky's done and is doing is very much in a great tradition. And of course, also, so is his physical courage, that none of us need doubt that President Putin, if he could, would kill him and will still be trying to kill him. He's remained in Kiev to be captured, if he could, which could well happen, because some of us think that in many ways, what we're looking at the moment, I wish that I could believe that militarily Ukraine could defeat Russia, but I don't think it can. I think we're about to see a terrible battle for Kiev, in which Russia will ultimately prevail. But what Zelensky has done for the rest of us, and this is enormously important, after a long period in which the West has been very spoilt, very passive, has believed that the Cold War was behind us, World War II was behind us, that the big threats are behind us, suddenly we're face to face with new threats, which suddenly one feels that Western peoples, including those of the United States and Britain and of the Europeans, even the ones who seemed almost self-emasculated like the Germans, are realizing that we have to stand up to these threats. And even as Ukraine is suffering almost on behalf of the rest of us.
Yeah. So Gina Scott-Ligon, the way I see it, just sort of keying off what Max Hastings says, is that in terms of one of the most important functions of President Zelensky's leadership right now, it is that it's more than just sort of performative. I mean, he is speaking to various audiences. There's, of course, the Ukrainian people. There's Russia as well, and the global community, as Max Hastings is saying here. Can you talk a little bit about the different ways in which he does that? Because Zelensky has been very, very targeted in talking about democracy, democracy, democracy every time he addresses any international audience. What do you think the significance of that is?
Yeah, I think you're seeing more than just a performative leader or someone who's gifted orally. I think, you know, one of the characteristics that you look at in leaders is their ability to empathize and to understand individual needs of different people, but also in different groups in this standpoint. And when you watch the fluency, how quickly he moves between different audiences and how he addresses them. And you can see it just very concretely in how he changes if he's speaking in Russian or English or Ukrainian. And he changes his messaging and even his face and how he communicates to them. And he's sending very specific signals. And that's just a true empath of someone who not only can read and feel emotions and what people need at that moment, but also respond and change how he communicates accordingly. I mean, people discount the fact that he was a comedian, but one of the personality characteristics of comedians is they have tremendous empathy for diverse audiences, and they're able to quickly read the room, if you will, and change how their jokes they're telling, pull on different threads that people are responding to. It's almost like this connection to humans that is, it's a very unique characteristic, and you see it in him, and it's just remarkable to watch how he's commanding. Mm. And to Max's point, it's the exact right time to do it.
Yeah. So, Max Hastings, we have about a minute before we have to take our first break here. Can you talk a little bit more about how Europeans in particular are witnessing and hearing Zelensky's message?
Europeans have been through a long period of oversleeping about defense and security, and especially the Germans have been almost disarmed. And suddenly, by the example of what's happened in Europe, they've come to understand that if we want peace, the old cliche, we must be willing to prepare for war, has never seemed more true. And God forbid that we should see an escalation. I mean, we may have a chance to talk later about the Cuban Missile Crisis, about which I've just been. But one thing that's terribly important, if you want to preserve peace, if you want to face down dictators or aggressors, which we're certainly dealing with here, you have to be in a fit state to fight. There has to be the threat of force behind it. And that's what's been missing. That's why Putin has believed for so long that we are weak, that we are decadent, and he can roll over us. And that is what is now changing, please God.
And it's Volodymyr Zelensky who's really sort of declaring that from the mountaintops. But the question is, how effective will he ultimately be? Because while he may have woken up Europe, Max Hastings, as we go into the break, I'll share this thought, but he's also perhaps not getting all the assistance that he requests in return. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're examining a profile in leadership in the form of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. I'm joined today by Gina Scott-Ligon. She studies leadership and is director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation, Technology, and Education Center at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. And Max Hastings joins us as well from England. He's a military historian, journalist, author, and columnist for the London Times, author of many books, including Winston's War. Now, Gina and Max, if you can just listen along for a moment. Of course, one of the most important audiences for Zelensky is the Ukrainian people themselves. He is their leader. So we wanted to get a deeper understanding of how Ukrainians are hearing and how important what Zelensky is saying is to them. So we reached out to Oleksiy Honcharuk. He served as Ukraine's prime minister from 2019 to 2020. He was also a member of Zelensky's Servant of the People Party, and he spoke with us from Kyiv, where he has remained since Russia began its attack.
Look, I believe that this is absolutely critical situation. Yeah, when the second military power in the world invaded your country, so it's impossible to be prepared.
Impossible for a country to be fully prepared and for its leader, he says. And he also said this is really more about more than just Zelensky. Honcharuk says this is about Ukraine and its defense of democracy and how Ukrainians would have resisted Russia's invasion regardless of its president's actions, even if Zelensky had chosen to leave the country.
Even in this case, Ukrainian nation would stand till the end. So it's not Zelensky's choice. It's a choice of our nation. But Zelensky is a part of this nation. And Zelensky now is a symbol of our nation. That's what gives Zelensky a historic chance, I believe, to become a great leader. But it's only a chance. It will depend on his further actions, I believe.
Honcharuk says there was no guarantee before February 24th that Volodymyr Zelensky would rise to this moment. The comedian-turned-politician proved to be a poor manager before the war. For example, in 2021, the International Monetary Fund was willing to help with Ukraine's growing debt problem, but Zelensky looked for ways to circumvent the IMF's reform conditions while still taking a $5 billion financial package. So Honcharuk says Zelensky made mistakes.
Maybe even a lot of mistakes. And that's why he lost a big part of his support among the population of Ukraine. But it doesn't matter now. He passed the final and maybe the main test.
That test? Zelensky did not abandon his country. He risked his life, stood on the streets of Kyiv, and said, "I'm here." Honcharuk says it's impossible to overestimate the importance of that, especially since that moment proved Ukraine's president had political gravitas to match his theatrical charisma.
Doubtless, he has charisma as a person, but look, he is not a big ideological leader, you know. So there is no special or very strong idea behind him. He wasn't a leader of revolution, of a big revolution. But now he become a special person.
In other words, the war made him. Honcharuk also says Zelensky, even as a wartime president, realizes that his role isn't necessarily military or strategic. It's to rally hearts and minds, a wartime cliche, but one that seems so urgent now. And Honcharuk adds that Zelensky trusts the advisors around him, and critically, they trust him.
All his team around him consider him as a only and only possible leader and believe him, trust to him. And that's why I'm not surprised that he acted like he acted.
And those actions mean something to all Ukrainians, including Oleksiy Honcharuk. Recall, he spoke with us from Kyiv. And no matter how close the Russian military advances, Honcharuk says he will not leave the city.
Not only because I love my city and it's my home and I'm ready to protect it, but because I have no any doubts that the president will stand until the end.
That was Oleksiy Honcharuk, Ukraine's prime minister from 2019 to 2020. Now, Gina Scott-Ligon and Max Hastings, there's a lot that emerges from that conversation we had with Honcharuk. But Max Hastings, let me turn to you first. How much does it matter what do you hear when Honcharuk said that it was important for people to see, the Ukrainians to see, that Zelensky had a political gravitas to back his sort of televisual charisma? And that is what, in part, what they have rallied around over the past several weeks.
You can argue a case that the hard part for Zelensky has not started yet, that he's been able to deliver the inspirational message. But a very important part of successful, really distinguished leadership through the centuries has been a willingness to tell people not only things they're willing to hear, but also things they don't want to hear. And I think that's the hard part approaching for Zelensky. All of us, we are mere spectators of this terrible drama. What we're witnessing Let us be honest about this. We are witnessing as spectators from our comfortable homes in the United States and Britain and Europe, the martyrdom of Ukraine at the hands of this unbelievably brutal Moscow regime. But at some point, I mean, I was talking this morning to a very senior military friend of mine, and he remains convinced that the Russians are going to prevail in this struggle, that there's going to be a mortally nasty battle for Kiev, in which the Russians may well use very unpleasant chemical or biological weapons. And in the end, the Russians, by sheer brute force, such as they've employed many times over the last century or two, are going to win. Well, the one question in my mind about Zelensky's leadership and the leadership of the rest of the Western powers, because we're living into a time when we need big people governing our respective countries. And I'm afraid, I think in large part, we've got small people. This doesn't make it any easier. And one of the things that I think our responsible leaders in our countries should be saying to Zelensky, look, the world hugely admires, or a lot of the world, what you're doing. But in the end, almost certainly, there's going to have to be a conversation with these loathsome Russians that you cannot beat the Russian army. And the only question that matters is what is in the best interests of the Ukrainian people. And I think sometime there's going to have to be a deal. And that is very unpleasant. I mean, when I wrote this in the London Times last week, that a stream of readers wrote in to say, you can't compromise with these horrible people and so on. But the fact remains, I think we just have to keep saying that without being too dewy-eyed about the extraordinary achievement of President Zelensky, that most wars end with conversations, and most wars, there has to be unpleasant compromises. And I've just been writing this book about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is going to be published in the fall. And one thing that strikes me is, well, there's two things that strike me. One, President Kennedy, part of his greatness, and I think he did achieve greatness in the missile crisis, was that he realized from the beginning that there was going to have to be some sort of bargain with the Russians to get their missiles out of Cuba. And secondly, diplomacy alone could never have got the result. There had to be the threat of force, that it was the threat of overwhelming American force. The fact that the United States was known to have both the will and the means to bomb and invade Cuba, if Khrushchev didn't give way, that was essential to make the diplomacy work. And in the same way today, I think on the one hand, thank God at last, after its long sleep, the West is talking about rearming, is talking about preparing, if necessary, to meet the Russians in arms. Mm. But also, we should accept we cannot. Putin is a fact. He's a horrible fact. But at some point, Zelensky is going to have to talk to Putin. There's going to have to be some sort of deal, which is very hard to make. But I do believe that our leaders should be saying to Zelensky, do not kid yourself that we are going to send the U.S. cavalry to bail you out. In the end, it's going to be you versus the Russians, and then there are more of the Russians. So there's going to have to be a conversation.
Yes.
But this is a tough message, and it's much harder to give unwelcome tidings than it is to give things people want to hear.
Yes. So, Gina Scott-Ligan, I want to hear you on that. But first, let's just play a moment from a recent... I'm not sure if we can call it an overture, because I'm not entirely sure about what the purpose of Zelensky's tone was when last week he actually called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to meet face to face. And here's how he did it.
Sit down with me at a negotiating table. I'm free. Sit down with me. But not at a 30-meter distance like with Macron, Scholz, or others when you receive them. I am your neighbor. You don't need to keep me at a 30-meter distance. I don't bite. I'm a normal guy. Sit down with me. Let's talk. What are you afraid of?
So, Gina Scott-Ligan, respond to what Max Hastings says about that the hardest work for Volodymyr Zelensky may be yet to come.
Yeah, one of the things that when you look at these extreme leaders is you want to see what they do once they have the attention, right? And so he's been remarkable at getting the attention of the world. What's he going to do now that he has it? And so one of the things that I've seen in him, and you heard it in that clip, is this, he's using his influence for the good of others. It would be very easy for him to dehumanize Putin, to dehumanize the troops, to liken them to, subhuman traits or people. But he's not. He's saying, I'm your brother. He's trying to remind everyone of the commonality, this human need that we all have to be connected. And psychologically, that is incredibly unique and powerful, because one of the things we want in leaders is we want them to be what's called a prototypical leader. We want them to represent the best version of ourselves. And so that's what I think he's doing right there, is he's showing, listen, I'm dealing with a monster right now, a murderous monster, but I'm reminding him of my humanity and that we're related, we're brothers. And what he's doing there is he's actually talking to the Ukrainian people about Russians who are there, and he's talking to the Russians about their orders to kill their own brothers. And so it's just a remarkable skill that you see in this leader.
Yes. So let's talk more in more detail about what commonalities we see in those people that sort of we deem to be great leaders. And Max Hastings, of course, I mean, you've written about extensively about Churchill. Tell me if you had to give a summary of the things that made Churchill a great leader for his nation in his time, what would it be?
There are three or four things one picks out. He had an extraordinary eye. First thing we have to remember about Churchill was that if he died in 1939, one of his biographers wrote a book called Churchill, A Study in Failure. Hmm. And that made the point that if Churchill had died in 1939, before World War II, his whole record was of failures, and some very important failures. World War II proved to be, in the most extraordinary fashion, his moment. Now, one of the big things, he had an extraordinary eye for picking out what mattered, for picking out fundamentals. And one thing, in the summer of 1940, I'm in no doubt that if any other possible leader had been in charge of Britain, they would have almost certainly sought some sort of deal which was not available with the Nazis. And Churchill alone saw that the Nazis represented a force so evil that at all costs they had to be fought literally to the death. And he saw this with extraordinary clarity. Now, I'm sure some people hearing me say that will say, well, if you think that, why don't you think the same about President Putin, that he's a force so evil he has to be fought? Well, there are two points about that. One is, I don't think we should compare other national leaders to Hitler. Hitler was a uniquely satanic figure. And secondly, Putin has nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And whether we like it or not, in the same way that the world has not felt able to do much about North Korea, because North Korea has nuclear weapons, secondly, compromises have to be made. So I don't think you can compare Hitler with Putin today. Going back to Churchill in 1940, a second thing was his extraordinary willingness to tell people stuff they didn't want to hear, in that, for example, after Dunkirk and the withdrawal of the British army from Dunkirk, which was a sort of miracle, the British were in a ridiculous mood of self-congratulation. They thought, gosh, haven't we done well then? And Churchill had the courage to stand up in the House of Commons and say, wars are not won by evacuations. And that was symbolic of his willingness to tell people these harsh truths. And he understood this. And in the same way, in 1941, when June 1941, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, most British people hated the Soviets. They hated the Bolsheviks. They saw them as the killers of the Tsar. They saw them as these mass murderers, which of course they were. But Churchill clearly understood we couldn't fight everybody. And therefore, he reached out to embrace Stalin. He realized that although Stalin was an unbelievably wicked man, that we had to bargain with him. So he was a realist when a lot of his generals and a lot of his colleagues in the British cabinet felt that they wanted to have nothing to do with the Russians. They just wanted to, that there was a British general wrote in his diary just after the invasion started. He said, would that the two loathsome monsters, Germany and Russia, could drown together in the mud of the Soviet Union. And that was the overwhelming mood. So Churchill's sense of realism was extraordinary. And finally, he did have a quite extraordinary compassion. Mm. Now, it's remarkable how many great leaders are very good at simulating being warm human beings, but actually aren't, in that I have unbounded admiration for both Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy. But I personally believe that at root, they were rather cold human beings who were very good at simulating warmth. They were outstanding leaders, but how much did they really care about people? I'm not so sure. Whereas with Churchill, he cared passionately. He was always, he burst into tears at the drop of the hat when he thought about suffering mankind. And two particular moments I've mentioned in my books. One day while at, on a Friday night, he was driving to Chequers, his country residence, from Blitz, London, and he saw a queue of people outside a shop, and he asked his private detective to get out of his car and see what they were queuing for. And his detective came back and said, they're queuing for bird seed, for their pet birds. And his private secretary wrote, Winston wept.
Hmm. Max Hastings, if I may, I just have to take another quick break. We have a lot more to discuss about leadership in wartime, and specifically Volodymyr Zelensky. So, Gina Scott-Ligon, I'll turn back to you when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're examining a profile in leadership in the form of Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. By the way, he's speaking to the United States Congress tomorrow, of course, via video. He'll be in Kyiv as the Russians advance ever closer and bomb Kyiv itself. I'm joined today by Max Hastings. He's a military historian, journalist, and columnist, author of many books, including Winston's War, and a forthcoming book as well about the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's with us from England. And with us from Omaha, Nebraska, is Gina Scott-Ligon. She studies leadership and is director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation, Technology, and Education Center at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. And Gina, before the break, we were listening intently to Max's description of Churchill's, in a sense, how his leadership came to full flower in the Second World War. It was fascinating to hear that if he had died in 1939, it would have been a study in failure. But Max was also talking about Churchill's masterful use of the language, his ability to tell hard truths, and his empathy for the people he was leading. And so I just want to play this quick bit of tape of Volodymyr Zelensky on day 10 of Russia's invasion, once again speaking to the Ukrainian people.
Сьогодні субота. Субота. Це слово на війні.
But during wartime, this word Saturday means little, just like Monday or Thursday or any other day. They have all become the same. We defend our state all the same. We rescue our people all the same. The country no longer knows weekends. It doesn't matter what the clock says, what the calendar says. And it will be like that until victory comes.
Gina, what other characteristics do you think are common to the leaders that we talk about? Churchill, of course. Max mentioned FDR, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Dr. King. I mean, what are the other common factors you see?
Yeah, I think that there's two pieces that I want to pull the thread on from what Max just said about, picking out what matters. I think that's one of them. And then the other is I do want to challenge about how Putin compares to Adolf Hitler. So I'll talk about both of those. But first, let's talk about picking out what matters. So, you know, I lead a terrorism center here at Omaha, but it's sponsored by Department of Homeland Security. And one of the strains of terrorism that is happening right now in the U.S., but also all over, is something called agave extremism. That's anti-government, anti-authority, violent extremism. And so there's this sentiment across people right now of rejecting authority figures, whether it be media like NPR or authority figures in government or corporate structures, traditional strains of authority. There's a lack of a trust and there's a hunger for authenticity. And so what you see Zelensky picking up on, and you see this in how he dresses and how he's wearing these you know, a crew neck T-shirt juxtaposed, you know, behind him in this ornate government building, is this sentiment he's picked up on that is resonating with a lot of people, which is the anti-hero, right? The anti-government hero. But he's doing so in a much more socialized way. I mean, you saw Donald Trump did it a bit in the United States, you know, when he talked about the swamp, and I'm contrasting to the swamp. Zelensky is personifying that right now with just by virtue of his background and how he's comporting himself in front of the camera. So I think he is picking out what matters to a wide variety of people, which is why you're seeing him getting audiences. And honestly, you know, other world leaders right now would do well to co-brand with him. Sorry to sound corporate, but, you know, it's a strain that a lot of people are feeling, this hunger for authenticity and for not having these leaders in these suits that, you know, have $400 haircuts, but to have, you know, someone that's not clean shaven and looks like them, but honestly portrays the very best features of them. And that's that prototypical leadership.
Mm-hmm. And you wanted to talk about the Putin-Hitler comparison as well.
Yeah. You know, I've studied Putin a long time. And, you know, I would say that he could possibly be more dangerous, or at least as dangerous as Hitler. Let me tell you why. You know, history is not going to remember him kindly, but there's a lot that the American people do not know about him because of the way that he censors media and the way that he is not, you know, he surrounded himself with sycophants. And so the war atrocities that we're seeing on display right now are just the tip of the iceberg. You know, we are going to find out as history proceeds, hopefully after he is gone, that he has committed war crimes that will be the most atrocious that any of us have gotten to see in our lifetimes. And, you know, the fact that he has nuclear weapons also, you know, if you look at your show you had yesterday, makes him much more dangerous because he's willing to use them. And so I am more frightened by Putin's leadership style than any leader that we have seen. And I very much think that it is an all hands on deck exercise. We need the Zelenskys, but we also need the Bidens. We need the pragmatists to marshal all of our forces to be able to confront what I would consider the most evil and dangerous leader that we have seen.
Well, so Max Hastings, just so you know, Gina Scott-Ligan there was referring to our show yesterday where we talked about potential paths that could lead to a nuclear launch, whether it be intentional or accidental. But, you know, one thing I'm both hearing you say consistently through this hour is that while even though, you know, our putative focus is on Volodymyr Zelensky's leadership, in a sense, his actions now are bringing into sharp relief the necessity for brave leadership elsewhere in the world. I mean, Max Hastings, is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yes, I think it is a source of deep concern to many of us that I used the phrase earlier that we're living in an age when we need big people in charge. I'm afraid all over the world we're seeing an alarming number of small people in charge. I don't think we need to be too particular about individuals, but it is disturbing that, as I say, one of those proverbs, cometh the hour, cometh the man. I'm afraid that's often not true, that the man or the woman often don't come. That I would like to think that, I mean, one thing that worries me greatly is what one might call compassion fatigue, that today the world is, or a large part of our world, is deeply agitated and inspired by Zelensky and appalled by what's happening in Ukraine. Pray God we can maintain the momentum, and this will partly depending on our leaders having the courage and the clarity to tell us that we've got to be in this for the long haul. This crisis is not going to be over anytime soon. Whatever happens in Ukraine, we're living in a new world as a result of this, in which a number of serious commentators have said that it's likely to create a much more fundamental change than did 9/11, because 9/11, in the end, these Muslim terrorists, although they had the power to cause us great distress, they didn't have the power to blow up the world as these people do. I'm not quite sure I go so far as to say that Putin is more dangerous than Hitler, but he certainly has extraordinary power to create grief. So I think one thing that is important is for our leaders to shape up, and we've got to find leaders who are capable of matching the seriousness of this hour. And I'm constantly reading the speeches made by leaders around the world and being dismayed by how inadequate a lot of their words are in seeming to inspire their peoples. Another thing I think very important to point out: we live in a Western bubble in which the United States and Britain and West European, we share values. But I think it's very depressing to see how many countries in the world are either remaining silent in the face of what's happening here or are actively supporting Putin.
Yeah.
That India and Pakistan, their very equivocal attitude is frightening. India, the world's largest democracy, many African countries, many other countries. So we have to maintain the sense of proportion to understand that part of the reason we should be alarmed by what we're seeing is the substantial number of nations that don't seem frightened by autocracies, that don't seem frightened by aggressors, and are prepared to go along with Putin. So he's not as totally isolated as we would like
indeed,
to see him.
Indeed. And by the way, on Friday of this week, we're trying to put together a show about China and its actions in this moment now. But Max Hastings and Gina Scott-Ligon, just hang in here for a second, because, you know, in this trying to understand what makes a great leader, and especially how a politician chooses to stand or not, we thought we'd reach out to someone who has been a political leader. So we talked with Bill Bradley. He served for 18 years as a senator from New Jersey. And we asked Senator Bradley what he sees in Ukraine's wartime president.
He has one job: rally his country. It's not manage a budget. It's not what is the relationship with the EU. It is, how do I keep the country afloat? How do I keep it alive? How do I get as much support as I possibly can for the country? How do I keep our spirits up? How do I give the rest of the world an opportunity to see the power of what strong leadership can do for our country in extremes?
Bradley told us that the key to leadership is being able to connect on an emotional level with the people that he or she is speaking to. And Max and Gina have said similar. It can be words or simple gestures. And Bradley himself recalls a moment in his own career when he made a connection like that. The year was 1992, and four Los Angeles policemen had just been acquitted of savagely beating Rodney King. And so while senators were gathered, Bradley got up to speak.
The senator from New Jersey.
Mr. President, what we have seen in Simi Valley, California, is a travesty of justice.
And when I got to the Senate floor, I was feeling very strongly about this, but then spontaneously, I paused and picked up a pen from my desk.
So we saw four police beating Rodney King.
And I hit without saying a word, I hit the podium 56 times in 81 seconds.
It was clear cut. 56 times in 81 seconds. Something like this. Boom. Pow. Pow. Pow.
And that act just really resonated with anyone who watched.
Pow. 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 Pow, 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 pow.
Because there was a direct connection with my feeling and my action.
Pow. Pow. That's what the American public saw on videotape.
Senator Bradley told us he admires how an apparently mediocre leader in Volodymyr Zelensky became a great one when the occasion demanded it.
Before this happened, his approval rating was 25%. Now it's 92%, which says a couple of things. One thing it says is a TV production company doesn't do a good job in running a country, but does a hell of a job in leading a country in a crisis where you have to have a narrative to convey. The second thing it says is that as a human being, he is tremendously courageous and believes very strongly in what he's doing and has provided a lifeline to people who may have doubted themselves and their country and their opportunity. And he's given people a reason to believe that their life can be better.
Former New Jersey Senator Bill Bradley. And we only have about 3 minutes left, Gina and Max. And I wonder if we dare look forward into the future a little bit. And Gina, I'll start with you because we've kind of hinted at this already. What happens in whatever the next phase of this war might be? If say the Russians are successful in their advances on the major cities of Ukraine, if there's an insurgency, is the kind of leadership that we've seen from Zelensky the kind of leadership that can be successful under those circumstances?
Yeah, I'm so glad you had that clip from Senator Bradley. That was just, I smiled the whole time. You know, one of the things that gives me a lot of hope, you know, I study extreme leadership and how it can be used for evil, right? And how these kinds of leaders that have this attention can turn it to just commit atrocities and get other people to do that. And one of the things I see in him is he is going to instill this remarkable loyalty from people around him and in a way that they're also going to commit acts of heroism and bravery. And so I think he'll be a very successful insurgent leader in this space. You know, the odds are on his side of being an insurgent leader with that domain expertise. I really see Ukraine being the next Afghanistan for Russia. Mm. You know, you look at what happened in Afghanistan in the 80s, and that's what Russia's getting. So buckle up.
Mm. Well, Max Hastings, in the minute or so we have left, last word goes to you today.
Our leaders must offer us hope. And also they must prepare us for the very long haul. That, again, reverting to Churchill, I know he's the exemplar for all time, but in one of Churchill's speeches, famous speeches, he said, this is not the end nor even the beginning of the end, but it's the end of the beginning. Now, alas, in my view, we're only at the beginning of the beginning of this crisis. But if our leaders can live up to the example set by President Zelensky of Ukraine, which we pray that they can, then we may be able to see this through, not to a happy conclusion, but to the least bad conclusion that the world can ask for.
Hmm. Well, Max Hastings, military historian, journalist, author, and columnist for the London Times and Bloomberg as well. He's also author of Winston's War and Soldiers, Great Stories of War and Peace, and a forthcoming book on the Cuban Missile Crisis called The Abyss. Max Hastings, thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Gina Scott-Ligon studies leadership and is also the director of the National Counterterrorism Innovation Technology and Education Center at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Gina Scott-Ligon, it's been a great pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.